Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Hello, I'm Alan McFadgen, AHDB's Knowledge Exchange Manager for Dairy in the North of England. And in this episode of Food and Farming Podcast, we're talking about genomics and utilising the genetics in your herd. I was recently joined by one of our newest strategic dairy farmers, John Bailey from Moorhouse Hall Farm in Cumbria, and Dr. Neil Eastham, who's a vet and Nuffield scholar, to understand what genomics can do for our industry. Now, given John's herd sits in the top 5 percentile for PLI, or Profit Lifetime Index, I began the conversation by asking him about his animals.
So, we have 120, well, moving up to 120 cows, 10,000 litre average, pedigree Holsteins, classify. And I think the other thing that I said was we have been genomically testing all our heifer calves since, I think it was 2014.
Recently we ran a workshop in understanding people and how to utilize people's herd genetic reports. So we had the kind of question of what does the top echelon of PLI look like and why do you want to strive for it? So I was just wondering why, given that you're in the top 5%, and I know that Neil's herd at home is in the top 1%, why you've aimed for that and what you're hoping to get from it.
There's such a lot of data out there and such a wide choice of bulls out there. PLI seems to me to be a very good initial screening tool, and certainly that's what we use it for. We then drill down and look for other things as well, but it's just you need to start somewhere, and it's a index that's designed to be used in this country, and the weighting seems to broadly suit the sort of cows we're trying to breed. So it's as simple as that, really. I wouldn't say that we have necessarily set a goal of being in the top 1%. I think it's just a natural progression because we've been using it as our initial screening tool, I think.
Neil, can you give us a little bit of background about yourself and your Nuffield and hopefully your journey with the farm at home as well?
Yeah, of course. Hi there. As Alan said, my name's Neil Eastham. I'm a practicing vet over in North Yorkshire. I graduated in 2007 from the University of Liverpool and went straight into farm practice over here. I'm now one of the partners. We have a team of 14 ruminant vets covering all of North Yorkshire. My interest in genetics stems from an upbringing on a dairy farm, like John's farm, pedigree Holsteins, similar level of production. My brother's now taken on the farm and I dip in and out, providing a bit of consultancy, if you like, as well as relief milking. And breeding and genetics is an area that my brother gives me, you know, a large amount of freedom to influence at home. So I'm still heavily involved in that. And yeah, I did a Nuffield scholarship looking at the use of genomic testing. At the time I started my Nuffield, only around sort of 3-4% of the UK's heifer crop was being tested. Obviously that's increased year on year. And what I sort of got out of that was huge, really. It was something we were doing at home. It was something that a small amount of my clients were doing. And what I wanted to explore was what the opportunity represented and understand what the barriers might be to more farmers doing it. And yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it and would recommend a Nuffield to anyone, really.
How do you know when the genetic potential is showing through in the herds and not just the environment that you've created around the cow? Can I put that to John first and then to Neil afterwards, if that's right?
Over the time we've been doing it, it's not a perfect correlation, but there is a definite correlation between those cows, that heifers that test high, and the yield that they go on then to produce through their lifetime. And I'm stressing lifetime, not necessarily in the heifer lactation, but over the lifetime. I don't think there's any doubt that for us, in the early days, we, you know, Chris, our son, have a play at, you know, plotting as cows would go in at the end of their lifetime, how they'd done. And there was a definite correlation there. So it just seems a no-brainer, really, that to use that information.
It's a really useful tool for a veterinary surgeon is the genetic data that's available, because what it allows us to do as vets is to assess whether a herd's getting a response from an investment in better genetics. Farmers like John are obviously giving it a huge amount of thought, and what we want to do is, as advisors, is to be able to assess whether they are getting a response, because if a farm's not realizing a response from genetics, i.e. the higher genetic merit cows are not outperforming the lower genetic merit cows, then that might point towards a management factor that's hampering their ability to express that potential. So as vets, I think we spend a lot of time looking at husbandry management factors. What we need to do, I believe, as well, is have an understanding of the herd's genetic potential so that we can realise when that potential isn't being realised, and we can maybe look to explore why that might be. And it might be that there's a management factor that's hampering that. So like John's son Chris, I spend a lot of time looking at that kind of data, working with my clients in a sort of holistic way, recognizing that genetics are sort of the building blocks for performance, as well as looking at the more traditional things that a farm vet would look at in terms of management.
You both utilize genomics. Could you have got the same results by just using parent averages, or do you think I'll start with Neil. Do you think that genomics has played a huge part?
Absolutely not. No, I think what genomics allows you to do, especially for the low heritability traits, the health traits, and that's an area I'm particularly interested in and we focused in on home, genomics really ramps up the reliability in a way that would be totally unattainable by just looking at parent average values. You know, these low heritability traits like fertility, lameness, mastitis, costly, and genomic evaluations allow us to have an insight into what the future of that animal looks like in a way that's completely unattainable with parent average. Reliability jumps are huge for those low heritability traits, and so for us at home, that was the biggest motivator for jumping on the genomic testing wagon early on, like John did.
Yeah, I mean, as Neil says, we've always used testables. My dad always used to use Genus ones, and we actually started using Cogent testables when they launched their program. You know, bulls of that age, you've got a typically on a parent average 35% reliability on most traits, whereas you 55 to 65, 70% even using genomic data, the reliability is so much greater. And we always thought that you should use testables because you're moving the not only your herd forward, but you're moving the national herd forward by allowing that proper comparison. So it was something we always felt that we should do. And it just takes so much of the gamble out of that. You accept that, okay, it's not, you know, 65% is not the 90% that you get on a decent first crop daughter average, but it's getting nearer. Okay, you'll see some falls. But if you try to use a range of bulls, don't get too wedded on any one, and try also not to have them too closely related, some will fall. But the group reliability starts to get very close to your individual bulls, daughter program bulls. So at that point, you've got a chance to start using genetics that are at least a generation ahead of where you would be. And it's cumulative. You then genomically test your heifers and go again, and that gap's going to grow. And I mean, we've seen since we started genomically testing, and like I say, it's not been a goal to get up the league tables, but we've gone from being comfortably in the top 20% to now being just outside the top 1%. And we do think that it's reflected in the performance of the daughters.
Neil, have you seen any actual financial numbers that show that the cows in your farm at home, sorry, I know it's your brother that runs it, but the farm at home, actually the top, say, 25 percentile or anything, have you seen anything that they're definitely proving this much more valuable?
Yeah, so, I mean, well, PLI in itself is an economic index. Just by looking at the leaps we've made in PLI year on year, because that's an economic index sort of weighted on those traits of economic significance, we know that, and there's work being done by HDB to back that up, that we are financially better off by pushing for that as our primary selection index. And like John said earlier, that would be our initial screening tool for when we're looking to whittle down either groups of bulls or in fact breeding females. But also what we have done is we've been genomic testing now since 2015, is we have looked at how performances played out for those animals, and across multiple different traits, be it production traits or health traits, we know that animals in the top quartile do go on and outperform their counterparts. And, you know, we've got work from our farm looking at traits like fertility and cell count to demonstrate that. And obviously behind those traits, a serious sort of financial figures between best and worst. So it is hard to quantify the value when there are environmental factors at work. But just by looking at PLI itself, we can see that we, because animals re-rank once your genomic test, having greater confidence in the ranking once you've genomic tested does allow you to attribute a financial value to the animals you work with against those that you don't. Yeah, it's definitely there's a saving to be realised by doing it.
That's Dr. Neil Easton. You're listening to a Dairy Genomics episode of HTB's Food and Farming podcast with me, Alan McFadgen. And to avoid any further waffling, let's jump straight back into the conversation with strategic dairy farmer John Bailey. I wanted to know if he looks at any other factors beside the profitable lifetime index when choosing bulls.
To be honest, the first thing I always look at after the PLI is milk. At the end of the day, that's what we're in business to produce. I always say to people, don't forget why you started using Holstein cows, and it was predominantly to get milk. So that's the first thing that we look for. We're now on a more solids-based contract, so maybe I'll have to just ease back a bit on that, but that's what I look for. And then the next couple of things I look for tend to be things that aren't included in PLI. So temperament, milking speed, that sort of thing, because they're not in the PLI. So I tend to look at those. Even when we weren't on a solids-based contract, I would never use anything with a big minus, because I always said you never know if your milk buyer might change what they're looking for, and you never know if you might change milk buyer. So it was silly to use a big minus, but I didn't particularly prioritise a big plus, which, like I say, I might have to change that weight. So obviously I look at weight of components as well as milk. And then it tends to be looking at type traits, lifespan as well. I've always gone quite heavily on lifespan, and we haven't tested our heifer calves yet this year. About now's the time we tend to do it, so that we've got the data when we start serving the next summer. But certainly when you looked last year on young genomically tested herds, young stock, if you ranked all the herds in the country on lifespan, we came out top. So it must be starting to show through. And I think it is starting to show through. I think we're starting to get a lot of good older cows. Because the beautiful thing about it is, it's not just that they live longer, it's that they live longer without causing problems. There's a lot of cows out there now that I could take you to look at, and people would never guess that they're as old as they are because they're wearing so well. So I do think that you can visibly see that these traits are starting to come through.
We would use PLI as a primary sort of screening tool, always aiming to use bulls that are above our highest female, so that we're realising that year-on-year progress. And then, like John said, production is important, so we do look across those different production traits. After that, lameness advantage is one that's getting more airtime with ourselves. My brother's herd is a housed 365 herd, and never too far away from butt troubles, so if we can reduce lameness, then that's got to be a win. So we look at lameness advantage, picking those bulls out of once we've whittled them down, picking those bulls with high lameness advantage values, and also fertility index. We've realised a lot of success in improving fertility in the herd over recent years, and attribute a lot of that to focus on fertility index, not only across the males, obviously, but also across the females when we're making breeding decisions. And mastitis and cell count is important in terms of udder health.
There is one little point. I am in the privileged position of being able to see your herd genetic reports, and it does look like John's young stock might be about to pass yours, Neil, as far as their PLI numbers. Do you have any feelings on that, or?
I would think, to be honest, you know, I think there's an element of luck there, because we use four or five bulls, and like you said, you know, and some drop more than others, and you have some years when quite a few of them seem to drop, and things are disappointing, maybe on the average, and we just seem to have had a couple of years where we've hit lucky, and we've used bulls whose figures haven't particularly dropped, because we haven't done anything any differently. I suppose the other element of luck as well is that I'll rank them by PLI, and then I'll start going down, knocking them out for temperament, milking speed, various traits. If I ever put all my traits into a program, it always comes back with no matches. There is no bull that meets all the criteria. What I'm trying to do is manually go through and, well, okay, that's not quite, but it's nearly. And then when you come up with your team of five, they've all got different reasons why they don't quite match. And then you corrective mate. So I think possibly also the other element of luck in the last couple of years is I've not had to drop as far down the list making my compromises before I've come up with a team, just because there must be more bulls out there at the moment or the last couple of years that have matched what I was looking for. So I'm not sure there's any, you know, that we've done anything any differently. I think we've just happened to land it in the right place. Whether that'll continue over the next few years, I don't know.
Knowing that John and Chris's is a well-run operation, I'm very happy to be overtaken, don't worry. So.
Good answer.
So I guess when we started genomic testing, John, the motivation for us was probably to find the bottom end. The high ones are nice, but the real value, I think, is to be realised in identifying the bottom ones. And, you know, we would use a lot of beef semen, about two-thirds of the milking herd are going to sexed male Angus at the minute. You know, if they don't conceive to that, they'll go to conventional beef. And then across the heifers, about 15-20% go straight to beef. What's your motivation for genomic testing your heifers? Is it to find the top ones or the bottom ones? And how are you managing?
No, you're right. Well, yeah, you're right. For us, because we've never gone down the route of flushing or anything, if there's a sky-high one, it doesn't get treated any differently. You know, it still gets a sex straw, just like a cow, just like one that's just below average gets a sex straw. So no, for us, and it's nice to know what they are, but it's for us, like you say, it's more about identifying those bottom, well, however many you might get. We don't have a hard and fast percentage. It's just depending on how many heifers you want to breed that year. But we've always bred off maiden heifers. We've always bred off young cows. And it's just a way of giving a much, well, you'd know reliability, really, have you? If you're starting on your own maiden heifers and you're relying on parent averages and what you know of the family, you've not got a lot to go on. And it's just about giving you so much more confidence if, right, well, those bottom three or four this year or those bottom six or seven this year or whatever it might be are, I'm sorry, but straight to Angus, which is not something that before we started genomic, you'd always find an excuse for why, oh, you liked its mum or you liked it or its dad or whatever, and they all ended up getting a chance pure or seemed to. It had to be pretty exceptional reason not to. Well, now there are a few every year that will just go straight to Angus. The rest will get two chances sexed. We've always very much had a closed herd. We breed our own replacements. And we're just looking to breed the best replacements we can, traditionally up to yet. That's what we've done. And weeding out those bottom 10, 15, 20%, whatever it might be, is a very, very good, effective way of raising your average.
So where do you see the value of being pedigree and classifying, you know, in the era of genomics?
Well, I still think we should be doing both, because hopefully as we go forward, that helped to refine the genomics. Hopefully, if enough analysis is being done across the breed, we should be able to start getting better at the genomic evaluation. I think we should be doing both. And it's also, I've got to admit, it's largely for our interest, it's hobby, really, because, yeah, there's a few people have said to me, actually, really, we don't get the benefit we should out of the classifying and the breeding, because we're not selling the females necessarily, or one or two surplus, but we're not going out and search. And if I do sell surplus, I could never bring myself to part with a young cow. We are not getting ourselves much benefit at all, you would argue, being pedigree and certainly from the classification. But I do think that if enough people are doing it across the industry, hopefully we're helping to move the breed forward.
And there's got to be that motivation to get out of bed in the morning and drag yourself into the milking parlour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If the cows look pretty as well as perform well on paper, then
well, if you've got to work with them every day, haven't you? So you might as well work with, if you can, you might as well work with something you want to. It's not as if the two things, as if following index and following traditional breeding, for us anyway, it's not as if they're completely different directions. A lot of people talk about it as if they are, and they're not. There is a big overlap. There's a lot of cows that it's got the high lifespan, it's got that good locomotion score and lameness advantage. And actually, when you look at the cow, you can see why. You know, all right, maybe that's partly because we do tend to try to breed both ways. Dickie Payne said to me years ago that it's not just about... if you look at it and the index says it's there, but you can't actually see why in the cow, it does raise a bit of a question, and you do just tend to maybe just go not as hard in that direction. And I think there's an element to that. And the classifier was saying when he was here last month, he says, the ones that do fall and are disappointing, he often, when he's classifying them, he can see why. It's a common sense thing. He was saying, if you look at them and it's coming back, massive high milk, massive high components, and really shallow udders, you're going to say, hang on, something's going to give, because it would be nice, and we're all trying to get there, but you're not going to get something that's at the extreme top end for all those. Because if you've got high milk and you've got high components, your management's going to have to be really good to get the good fertility as well, just to get the nutrients into it to make it. So he said, he said quite often if he sees shallow udders, good components, good fertility, loads of milk, he says typically what tends to happen on a genomic proof, typically what tends to happen is they'll be disappointed on the milk when they come back. Something's got to give. So we do try to strike that balance. So again, it's about gathering as much data as possible. So we're gathering the genomic data, but we're also doing the classification to get an idea for ourselves and within the herd about what physically do they look like they can actually do what the numbers say they can do.
What do you see as being the next big jump in genetic progress?
Traits around feed efficiency are going to be huge. We've obviously set ourselves this challenge of being net zero as an industry. There are a number of proprietary traits out there, and some of which have been out for a few years, which, you know, on the label it says they're going to help us get there. And I think those, alongside traits that are universally available through HDB, like feed advantage, like EnviroCow, those are going to be traits that we will continue to improve, and new ones will come along the way as well that will help us to achieve that. And I think that's hugely important, both at a farm level, but also, you know, at an industry level, to demonstrate to the consumer that we are serious about and sustainability, the environment, and all those buzzwords that are out there at the minute.
I would absolutely back that up. At the moment, we've all been using, largely been using proxy measures, if you will. So, you know, we've been relying on maintenance, we've been relying on, and I think we are now getting to a stage where there's some good evidence and we're starting to know what the markers are for the, like say, the EnviroCow. I think it's vitally important, as Neil says, both from an economic point of view, but probably even more to show the consumer that we're doing something. We have to get ahead of the game. We have to be able to show the consumer that milk from cows is a sustainable product, basically. And I think there's probably also scope for even more personalised indices, if you want, for people to start not just necessarily relying on the two or three that are out there, you know, but maybe starting to get more bespoke, refined weightings for their own use. I think there's got to be scope for that as well within breeding programs. But I think Neil's absolutely right that the key thing is to get our cows producing more efficiently, and it goes with it being healthy while they do it.
And here's where this episode of the Food and Farming Podcast draws to a close. I'm Alan McFadgen, AHDB's Knowledge Exchange Manager for Dairy for the North of England. And helping me drill down into the world of genomics was strategic dairy farmer John Bailey and vet and Nuffield scholar Dr. Neil Easton. A big thanks to both of them for taking part, and to you for listening. And if you want more on this topic, then visit ahdb.org.uk and search for genomics fact sheets. Cheerio.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.